Bonnie and Clyde robbed and roamed. To the north lay soy, sugarcane, and bean fields, oil derricks nodding in the far distance. Southeast of DeRidder, by 130 miles, sat Baton Rouge, the capital of Louisiana. Along the great Mississippi, between it and New Orleans, stand majestic plantation manor houses surrounded by gracious skirts of green lawn, where once lived the richest families in America. Now tourist sites, they are overshadowed by giant neighboring petrochemical plants, such as Shintech, ExxonMobil, and Monsanto. Lee has also become an ardent environmentalist due to things he had suffered, seen, and been ordered to do as a pipe fitter in a petrochemical plant. Calcasieu Parish, in which he had worked for 15 years at the Lake Charles-based Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company, is among the 2% of American counties with the highest toxic emissions per capita. According to the American Cancer Society, Louisiana has the second highest incidence of cancer for men and the fifth highest male death rate from cancer in the nation. But Lee has recently volunteered to post lawn signs for Tea Party Congressman John Fleming, who earned a score of 91 on the right-wing Freedom Works scorecard and favors cutting the Environmental Protection Agency, weakening the Clean Air Act, and drilling on the outer continental shelf, as well as opposing the regulation of greenhouse gases and favoring less regulation of Wall Street. Lee is a regular at meetings of the DeRidder Tea Party, wearing his red, white, and blue party t-shirt featuring an eagle sharpening its talons. So why was Lee the environmentalist eager to plant lawn signs for a politician calling for cuts in the EPA? If I could answer this question, maybe I could unlock the door to the great paradox. Maybe I could also find the key to Lee's own journey from left to right. For years, back when he worked in a naval shipyard outside Seattle, Washington, he had campaigned for Senator Scoop Jackson, a Cold War-era liberal Democrat who championed civil rights and human rights. Brought up by a working single mother who fought in the shipyards for equal pay for equal work, Lee describes himself as an ERA baby. When he came south for work in the 1960s, however, he turned Republican, and after 2009, he joined the Tea Party. We seat ourselves, pour our coffee, and I ask him to tell me about his childhood. Lee speaks slowly, deliberately, as if for posterity. I was a daredevil kid, one of seven boys. At around age seven, I roped down a bunch of poplar tree branches, tied myself to them, and released them so I could fly, Lee recalls with a laugh. I flew pretty high, he describes a broad arc with his arm, and landed in a prickly blackberry thicket. It hurt, but my mom didn't come get me because she wanted me to learn a lesson. I didn't, though, he added. Lee drove cars long before he had a license, and at age 12, stole, flew, and safely landed a neighbor's biplane. Even at a younger age, Lee was an active child. When I was about five, I got pneumonia and had to stay in bed for 3 months. My great-grandma, a Native American who lived on a Crow reservation in Montana, sat on me, not with me, so I wouldn't get up. That's how she kept me still so I could learn to crochet. As a young man, Lee trained as a coppersmith in the U.S. Naval Shipyards outside Seattle, where his dad worked as an electrician. When traveling south for work in 1965, Lee was hired by Pittsburgh Plate Glass as a maintenance pipe fitter and soon earned a workroom reputation as a mechanical genius. He can make nuts and bolts and rods and pipes and estimate lengths to the millimeter without having to measure or remeasure them, Mike Tritico, the environmental activist, told me when he put the two of us in touch. And on weekends, Lee raced cars. one of his plant supervisors always asking on Monday how Saturday's race had gone. Lee was fearless and careful, a good fit for his dangerous job at PPG, fitting and repairing pipes carrying lethal chemicals such as ethylene dichloride, EDC, mercury, lead, chromium, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, and dioxins. Mysteriously, these same chemicals had found their way into a nearby waterway called Bayou Din, a bayou on which a Cajun family, the Arinos, had lived for many generations and greatly suffered, and whose extraordinary connection to Lee we will learn. At one point, Lee narrowly escaped death, he tells me, taking a careful, long sip of coffee. One day while he was working, cold chlorine was accidentally exposed to 1,000-degree heat, which instantly transformed the liquid to gas. 16 workers were in the plant at the time. Noting that the company was short of protective gear, Lee's boss instructed him to leave. 30 minutes after I left, Lee says, the plant blew up. 5 of the 15 men I left behind were killed. The next afternoon, Lee's boss asked him to help search for the bodies of the 5 dead workers. 2 were found, 3 were not. Acid had so decomposed the body of one of the 3 victims that his remains came out in pieces in the sewer that drained into Bayou Din. If someone hadn't found him, Lee says, turning his head to look out his dining room window, that body would have ended up floating into Bayou Din. In the 1960s, safety was at a minimum at PPG. During safety meetings, Lee tells me, the supervisor just gave us paperwork to fill out. Working with the chemicals, we wore no protective facial masks. You learned how to hold your nose and breathe through your mouth. The company didn't much warn us about dangers, Lee says, adding in a softer voice, my co-workers did. They'd say, you can't stand in that stuff. Get out of it. I wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for my co-workers. The pipes Lee worked on carried oxygen, hydrogen, and chlorine. And when a pipe sprung a leak, he explains, I was the guy to fix it. Did you use your bare hands? I ask. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Eventually, the general foreman issued badges to the workers to record any overexposure to dangerous chemicals, Lee says. But the foreman made fun of them. It's supposed to take 2 or 3 months before the gauge registers you've reached the limit. My badge did in 3 days. The foreman thought I'd stuck it inside a pipe. Such was the scene in the late 1960s at the PPG plant in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Accidents happened. One day, Lee was standing in a room, leaning over a large pipe to check a filter, when an operator in a distant control room mistakenly turned a knob, sending hot, almond-smelling, liquid, chlorinated hydrocarbons coursing through the pipe, accidentally drenching him. It was hot, and I got completely soaked, Lee tells me. I jumped into the safety shower and had the respirator in my mouth, so I wasn't overcome, but the chemical was burning pretty bad. It really gets you worst underneath your arms, in between your legs, up your bottom. Despite the shower, he said, the chemical ate off my shoes. It ate off my pants. It ate my shirt. My undershorts were gone. Only some elastic from my socks and my undershorts remained. It burned my clothes clean off me. Lee's supervisor told him to go home and buy another pair of shoes, socks, undershorts, Levi's, and work shirt, and to bring in the receipts to be reimbursed. A few days later, he brought his receipts into his supervisor's office. The bill was about $40. But his supervisor noted about the incinerated clothes that he had already put some wear into them. You got about 80% use of the shoes and about 50% use of the pants, he told Lee. In the end, taking into account discounts for previous wear, Lee notes wryly, my supervisor gave me a check for $8. I never cashed it. Lee's work at PPG was a source of personal pride, but he clearly did not feel particularly loyal to the company. Still, he did as he was told, and one day after his acid bath, he was told to take on another ominous job. It was to be done twice a day, usually after dusk, and always in secret. In order to do this job, Lee had to wield an 8-foot-long tar buggy, propelled forward on 4 wheels. Loaded on this buggy was an enormous steel tank that held heavy bottoms, highly viscous tar residue of chlorinated hydrocarbon that had sunk to the bottom of kitchen-sized steel vessels. A layer of asbestos surrounded the tank to retain heat generated by a heater beneath the buggy. Copper coils were wound around its base. The hotter the tar, the less likely it was to solidify before it was dumped. Inside was toxic waste. Working overtime evenings, under cover of dark, his respirator on, Lee would tow the tar buggy down a path that led toward the Calcasieu ship channel in one direction and toward Bayou Din in another. Lee would look around to make sure no one saw me and check if the wind was blowing away from him so as to avoid fumes blowing into his face. He backed the tar buggy up to the marsh. Then he said, I'd bend down and open the faucet. Under the pressure of compressed air, the toxins would spurt out 20 or 30 feet into the gooey marsh. Lee waited until the buggy was drained of the illegal toxic waste. No one ever saw me, Lee says. The bird. Lee helps himself to a cookie, eats it slowly, and lingers over an event that occurred one day while he was alone on the bank with his secret. While I was dumping the heavy bottoms in the canal, I saw a bird fly into the fumes and fall instantly into the water. It was like he'd been shot. I put 2 shovels out into the mud so I could walk on them into the marsh without sinking too far down. I walked out and picked up the bird. Its wings and body didn't move. It looked dead, but its heart was still beating. I grew up on a farm, and I know about birds. I walked back on the shovels to the bank with the bird. I held its head in my right hand and its wings and body in my left hand. I blew into its beak and worked it up and down. Then it started breathing again. Its eyes opened, but the rest of its body still didn't move. I put it on the hood of my truck, which was warm. Then I left the bird to go check my tar buggy. But when I got back, the bird was gone. It had flown away. So that was one thing good. During the afternoon, Lee circles back to the story of the bird, alternating between it and the story of the tar buggy. I knew what I did was wrong, he repeats. Toxins are a killer, and I'm very sorry I did it. My mama would not have wanted me to do it. I never told anybody this before, but I knew how not to get caught. It was as if Lee had performed the company's crime and assumed the company's guilt as his own. But, like the bird, Lee himself became a victim. He grew ill from his exposure to the chemicals. After Lee's hydrocarbon burn, my feet felt like clubs, and I couldn't bend my legs and rise up, so the company doctor ordered me put on medical leave. I kept visiting the company doctor to see if I was ready to come back, but he kept saying I shouldn't come back until I could do a deep knee bend. Lee took a medical leave of 8 months and then returned to work. But not for long. After 15 years of working at PPG, Lee was summoned to an office and found himself facing a 7-member termination committee. "They didn't want to pay my medical disability," Lee explains. "So they fired me for absenteeism. They said I hadn't worked enough hours. They didn't count my overtime. They didn't discount time I took off for my Army Reserve duty. So that's what I got fired for. Absenteeism. They handed me my pink slip. 2 security guards escorted me to the parking lot." Lee slaps the table as if decades later he has just gotten fired again. The Fish Kill and the Showdown. 7 years later, Lee would meet an astonished member of that termination committee once again. There had been an enormous fish kill in Bayou Din, the bayou downstream from the spot where Lee had dumped the toxic waste and rescued the overcome bird, a bayou on which the Areno family lived. A Calcasieu advisory task force met to discuss the surrounding waterways, to describe them as impaired, and to consider issuing a seafood advisory warning people to limit their consumption of local fish. Local waterways had long been contaminated from many sources. But in 1987, the state at last issued a seafood advisory for Bayou Din, the Calcasieu Ship Channel, and the estuary to the Gulf of Mexico. The warning was shocking, the first in memory, and it called for limits due to low levels of chemical contamination. No more than 2 meals with fish a month, it said. No swimming, water sports, or contact with bottom sediments. It was a very belated attempt by the state of Louisiana to warn the public of toxins in local waters. Instantly, fishermen became alarmed. Would they be able to sell their fish? Would residents limit what they ate? Were they now being asked to look at fish not with relish for a scrumptious gumbo, jambalaya, or all-you-can-eat fish fry, but as dubious carriers of toxic chemicals? The carefully cultivated notion of harmony between oil and fishing, all this was thrown into question, and not just in Louisiana. 1/3 of all seafood consumed across the nation came from the Gulf of Mexico, and 2/3 of that from Louisiana itself. Many livelihoods were at stake, from net to plate. Fishermen, grocery stores, trucking companies, and restaurant workers all were furious at the government officials who had declared the seafood advisory. The government was a job killer, and many jobs were at stake. Shrimp provided 15,000 jobs. Oysters, 4,000 jobs, crab, 3,000 jobs, and crawfish provided 1,800 jobs, including 1,000 crawfish farmers and the 800 commercial fishermen who catch wild crawfish. By 1987, several things had transpired that would affect the fishermen's response to the edict. For one thing, PPG was not alone. Other industries had been polluting so much that Louisiana had become the number one hazardous waste producer in the nation. For another thing, the U.S. Congress had established the Environmental Protection Agency, 1970, the Clean Air Act, 1970, and the Clean Water Act, 1972. In addition, many small grassroots environmental groups had sprung up throughout the state, led by homemakers, teachers, farmers, and others appalled to discover backyard toxic waste, illness, and disease. Around the time of the advisory, local activists were rising up against toxic dumping around Lake Charles and nearby Willow Springs, Sulphur, Mossville, and elsewhere. part of the front porch or kitchen sink politics of the 1970s and 1980s. Peggy Frankland, a lively woman now in her early 70s, the daughter of farmers and a former homecoming queen in eastern Texas who now lives on a pecan farm in Sulphur, not far from PPG, describes the scene at the time of the seafood advisory. "We tore up my station wagon and my friend's husband's copy machine. We talked in churches, schools, met with Boy Scout leaders and officials in Lake Charles, Baton Rouge, and Washington, D.C. People said we weren't Christian, but animists who worshiped the earth instead of God. We were called zealots and country goats. We tried to meet state legislators who ignored us as silly housewives." As Frankland tells the story in her book, Women Pioneers of the Louisiana Environmental Movement, "Companies were treating our land and rivers like toilets, and we were standing up to it." As Frankland, a Democrat, noted, "We could say, hey, there's a federal law about clean water. You've contaminated our water. How are you going to clean it up?" But most of Franklin's activists are now Tea Party Republicans, and, like Lee Sherman himself, are averse to an overbearing federal government and even to much of the EPA. There it was, the great paradox through a keyhole. In the meantime, the Louisiana Department of Health and Human Services posted warning signs about fishing and swimming, signs promptly riddled with bullets or stolen. This, then, was the context when a member of the PPG Termination Committee had a surprise encounter with Lee Sherman. As Lee continues his story, we each take another cookie. Burton Coliseum, the largest public meeting place in Lake Charles at the time, was filled with about 1,000 angry fishermen and others in the fish industry. Lee continues, "When the meeting was called to order, it was standing room only. I could hear murmuring in the crowd. Oh, they were ready to kill the government." A row of company officials, including two from Pittsburgh Plate Glass, company lawyers, and state officials, all sat behind a table on a stage in front of the crowd. A state official stood to explain the reason for the seafood advisory. The fish had been contaminated. Citizens had to be informed. What had caused it? The officials from PPG seated on stage feigned ignorance. The meeting went on for 20 or 30 minutes, catcalls to the government officials rising from the crowd. Then, to everyone's astonishment, uninvited, Lee Sherman, long since fired by Pittsburgh Plate Glass, climbed on stage. With his back to the officials, he faced the angry fishermen, lifted a large cardboard sign, and slowly walked from one side of the stage to the other so all could read it. "I'm the one who dumped it in the bayou." The entire Coliseum went silent. Officials tried to get Lee to leave the stage, but a fisherman called out, "We want to hear him." "I talked for 36 minutes, Lee recalls. Someone said, "Sherman, you gotta sit down. It's so-and-so's turn to talk." But another guy said, "No, I want to hear him." "I told them I had followed my boss's orders. I told them the chemicals had made me sick. I told them I'd been fired for absenteeism. The only thing I didn't tell them was that sitting behind the front table on stage was a member of the PPG Termination Committee that had fired me. He had even once placed bets on my weekend NASCAR races. That was the best part. The PPG guys had both hands over the backs of their heads." Now the fishermen knew the fish were truly contaminated. Soon after the meeting, the fishermen filed a civil lawsuit against PPG and won an out-of-court settlement that gave a mere $12,000 to each. Another realm, another vindication. Lee had worked at hard, unpleasant, dangerous jobs. He had loyally followed company orders to contaminate an estuary. He'd done his company's moral dirty work, taken its guilt as his own, and then been betrayed and discarded himself as a form of waste. The most heroic act of Lee's life had been to reveal to the world a company's dirty secret, and to tell 1,000 fishermen, furious at the government, that companies like PPG were to blame. Yet over the course of his lifetime, Lee Sherman had moved from the left to the right. When he lived as a young man in Washington State, he said proudly, "I ran the campaign of the first woman to run for Congress in the state." But when Lee moved from Seattle to Dallas for work in the 1950s, he shifted from conservative Democrat to Republican, and after 2009, to the Tea Party. So while his central life experience had been betrayal at the hands of industry, he now felt, as his politics reflected, most betrayed by the federal government. He believed that PPG and many other local petrochemical companies at the time had done wrong, and that cleaning the mess up was right. He thought industry wouldn't do the right thing by itself. But in the role of counterweight, he rejected the federal government. Indeed, Lee embraced candidates who wanted to remove nearly all the guardrails on industry and cut the EPA. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration had vastly improved life for workmen such as Lee Sherman, and he appreciated those reforms, but he felt the job was largely done. In the life of one man, Lee Sherman, I saw reflected both sides of the great paradox, the need for help and a principled refusal of it. As a victim of toxic exposure himself, a participant in polluting public waters, hating pollution, now proudly declaring himself as an environmentalist, why was he throwing in his lot with the anti-environmental Tea Party? Not because the Koch brothers were paying him to, at least directly. Lee was putting up Tea Party lawn signs for free. Still, his source of news was limited to Fox News, and videos and blogs exchanged by right-wing friends, which placed him in an echo chamber of doubt about the EPA, the federal government, the president, and taxes. Indeed, Tea Party adherents seemed to arrive at their dislike of the federal government via three routes: through their religious faith — the government curtailed the church, they felt — through hatred of taxes, which they saw as too high and too progressive, and through its impact on their loss of honor, as we shall see. Lee's biggest beef was taxes. They went to the wrong people, especially welfare beneficiaries who lazed around days and partied at night, and government workers in cushy jobs. He knew liberal Democrats wanted him to care more about welfare recipients, but he didn't want their PC rules telling him who to feel sorry for. He had his own, more local and personal, way of showing sympathy for the poor. Every Christmas, through BoCare, a Beauregard Parish nonprofit community agency, he and his wife, Miss Bobby, chose 7 envelopes off a Christmas tree and provided a present for the child named on the enclosed card. "The card tells you a child's shoe size. If the size is too big, we know the shoe is actually going to an adult, and we don't give. But my wife spends money we don't have on the kids." Indeed, Lee and Miss Bobby were living on Social Security and finding it a very tight squeeze. Two events further soured him on the IRS. In one, he got a part-time job to earn a little extra money, but worked more hours than federal rules allowed, got caught, and had to wait a year to get back on Social Security. Only help from their Mormon church and from Mike Tritico, himself poor, saw Lee through that year. More enraging was a second event. "I made a date with a clerk in the local IRS office to collect a tax refund of a certain amount, and nothing about that meeting did I like," Lee explains. The gal wore a see-through blouse to distract me. Then she asked me for every possible receipt, tallied the amount up wrong, and gave me less than I had coming. She cheated me. I needed that money, but I never cashed that check. I'm a stubborn man, Lee explains, and if you cross me, I don't ever forget it. He wanted to feel vindicated, just as he'd felt against PPG's accusations of absenteeism when a member of the termination committee appeared at the seafood advisory meeting in the Burton Coliseum. He'd also found vindication, he felt, against that government clerk, all IRS clerks, and indeed the source of all taxes, the government. He'd gotten even. He'd done another Burton Coliseum. He'd joined the Tea Party. Lee had been mad when PPG fired him, two guards marching him out to the parking lot. I have a gun, he tells me, and I didn't think of hurting people, certainly not my co-workers. But the place? Yes, I was that mad. But at the same time, the workplace had been where he'd experienced his finest hour, had shown his great skill, his bravery, his endurance, his manhood. And when he added it all up, he was more mad at the government. PPG gave him money. The government was taking it away. 3.5 hours after sitting down with Lee at his dining room table, the cookies are gone. As I take my leave, Lee gets back up on his walker and slowly sees me to his front porch, which stands adjacent to a 4-door garage, the garage is bigger than the house, in which sit 3 race cars in various stages of repair. Leaning along one wall is a stack of 30 plastic lawn signs Lee plans to plant in local lawns for John Fleming, Tea Party candidate for the U.S. Congress. As we part, Lee flashes me a bright smile, invites me back. We haven't yet looked at his photo album, and waves a cheery goodbye. After those secret sessions at dusk, emptying the tar buggy into the public waters of the estuary, the toxic waste had moved downstream into Bayou Din, where I'd heard a couple had long lived. Were they part of the paradox, too? I thought I should meet them. 3. The Rememberers. I am seated on a soft living room couch in the home of Harold Areno, a gentle Cajun pipe fitter who is carefully holding before me, from his adjacent chair, a large photo album. He draws his hand back and forth over the plastic covers on the black and white photos. He turns the pages slowly, searching for one. 77, and a former deacon in the Lighthouse Tabernacle Pentecostal Church, he's dressed in a plaid shirt and jeans. He speaks in a slow baritone, his eyes on the page, often concluding a line of thought with a light chuckle, as if to say, "It's all right." He points. There it is. His mother, father, himself, and 9 siblings, standing in 2 rows, squinting into the sun on the bank of Bayou Din. It is 1950. Harold names his brothers and sisters. He tells how his mother used to catch gar by coaxing the fish to the side of the boat with bait, patting their sides, then lifting them by the gills into the boat. He turns to the next page of his album slowly. Now a photo of his father and his siblings, all born and raised just across Bayou Din, a term meaning Bayou of the Indians. Now, in different constellations, the family is picnicking, now clowning, now swimming, now dropping a watermelon off a boat to play with in the water and later eat. But it's not just his family he wants me to see. As if introducing friendly neighbors, he points behind the family to something else. Standing proud in the water, behind the faces in the photograph, are commanding bald cypress trees, large triangular trunks rising from the water, once the glorious queens of the forested wetlands of southern Louisiana, and still the official state tree. Green moss hangs from outstretched lower branches, tree after tree, like lace shawls in a dance hall. "They were so tall, the sun hardly hit the marsh," Harold says in a quiet voice. Reaching 150 feet high, these trees can live 600 years, and some have been known to live 1,700 years. Harold's father built fishing boats out of cypress, some flat-bottomed dugout pirogues traditional to Cajun culture. He would bring logs to a nearby mill, saw them in his shop, and build them into boats, which he rented to fishermen. For $30 a month, he also tended a humpback bridge, which could be swung sideways by turning a wheel to make way for boat traffic. And otherwise, he fished and farmed. "Throw a Cajun in a swamp," Harold chuckles, his eyebrows lifting for emphasis, "and he can make a living." But that was before. From the edge of his yard, Harold points to the bayou's brackish water. Piercing its surface here and there are lifeless gray trunks, some bent over like defeated soldiers, as far as the eye can see. It's a tree graveyard. Harold's arm falls to his side, limp. Bayou Din winds a few miles from the spot where Lee Sherman had leaned over the tar buggy, opened the valve, and let the toxic waste spew out into public waters. From that spot, the waterway led in one direction toward the Arinos, and in the other, it narrowed into the Calcasieu ship channel, widened into intertidal mudflats dotted with salt meadow cord grass, and poured ponderously south, 30 miles into the Gulf of Mexico, from which comes nearly half the seafood on the American dinner table. From the tar buggy dumpings in the PPG marsh, there was a very large downstream. By following Lee's deeds to the Arinos, I hoped to discover a different vantage point on the great paradox. Going on 3 generations, the Arinos have fished, caught game, and raised gardens on land around and beneath their immaculate tan wooden home with green shutters, neatly trimmed lawn, and driveway edged in lilies and hibiscus, a white truck in the driveway. Facing the water is a porch, along one side of which hangs an enormous American flag. The Arinos' home is one of only 2 on Bayou Din Pass Road for about a mile. The house next door, once Harold's sister's, has long lain vacant. Other families, too, have moved out, leaving a long stretch of scrub pine between the narrow tar road and the bayou.
"We didn't know what we had until it was gone," Harold says.
He had grown up on one side of the bayou and raised a family on the other,
within hollering distance of his birthplace.
But in addition to losing his youth, his trees, and many in his family, Harold has lost a way of life.
"We had 40 acres, he tells me, the photo album now resting closed in his lap. On 2 of them we grew butter beans, corn, and vegetables. We could catch frogs at night and fish in the daytime. Gar, bass.
There were other fish, too, he says. Crocker, menhaden, striped mullet, and redfish, which all had once fed the great snowy egrets, white and brown pelicans, gulls, herons, spoonbills, terns, and killdeer, birds that had once thrived in the bayou.
The frogs would sing and carry on all night long. You could drink the water then.
Harold and his 9 siblings settled across the family's 40 acres of land along the bayou.
We didn't go to the store but once a month to get sugar, vanilla, and such. We had chickens, hogs, cows, and a garden. We lived off the bayou. We ate bullfrogs for Sunday dinner, and catfish chowder any time. We'd add the sugar and vanilla to the cream from our cows to make our own ice cream. My mama was a French lady, Harold declares. She spoke French, played the watermelon man on her accordion, and cooked 3 meals a day for 12 on a wooden stove. She was a big woman, about 220 pounds, Harold says. She'd kill a chicken, put the meat in a pot of gumbo, and use the guts for bait on a line to catch catfish. We didn't waste nothing.
Like many in southwest Louisiana, the Arinos were descended from French Catholic Acadians, or Cajuns, as they came to be called. The British harshly expelled the Cajuns from New Brunswick, Canada, in 1765, in the wake of a victorious war against France. British ships deposited them in various coastal states. Eventually, 7 boatloads of Cajuns arrived in New Orleans Harbor, many of whom then migrated to the swamplands of southwest Louisiana, mingling with and partly displacing the Atakapa Indians. His parents had little schooling, as Harold recounts, because French was banned from schools, and French speakers were discouraged from attending. Harold himself only got through the 8th grade. Like Harold, Annette Arino remembers the bayou from before. A beautiful woman in her 70s, she has golden gray ringlets drawn high on her head. She wears glasses, a pink blouse, and long floral-patterned skirt. A warm, spirited woman, she speaks in a soft, deliberate way. She listens to Harold's stories, supplementing and amending them, carrying the seriousness of them in her tone of voice, but freely offering her own observations and thoughts about the bayou, comparing it to her grandfather's farm where she grew up in Kinder, Louisiana. She has recently won a Lifetime Achievement Award as custodian at nearby Sulphur High School.
"I clean up after teenagers," she says with a playful roll of her eyes. "I remember sitting under the cypress for shade in the heat of the summer. The moss hanging on it was green then. Frogs could breathe, and they could find all kinds of minnows. Then industry came in. It began to stink so bad you had to leave the windows down on hot nights. It killed the cypress and grass from here clear out to the Gulf. And you still can't eat the fish or drink the water."
Harold adds,
"Floating bits of rubber would clog the water pump on your motorboat. We were downstream from Firestone."
The Arino's 46-year-old son, Derwin, arrives at the door. A lively, brown-haired pipe fitter, like his dad, who works at a nearby petrochemical plant, he is dropping by on his day off with takeout from Popeyes. Chicken, rice and beans, coleslaw, sweet rolls. Annette makes coffee and puts out lunch for all of us, apologizing for not cooking herself. After prayer, Derwin joins in on what seems like a well-worn family conversation.
"I was born in 1962, and growing up here, all I ever remember seeing was dead cypress trees and a stinky, nasty smell from the water. Now, wherever I go, I can smell whether the water and air are good or bad. It's like a special instinct. The water here is clearer today on the surface, but you don't want to stir the mud on the bottom. And these days at night, the winds from the east smell of something burning, always at night. I haven't heard a bullfrog in this bayou for years," Harold adds. "I heard one holler about 3 years ago from inside one of them drains, but he didn't holler long. I don't know if someone caught him or if he died."
Harold describes how during a fish kill, the fish flopped about on the surface of the water and on the banks,
trying to breathe.
Then he turns to turtles, and I gradually realize we are going through a terrible inventory.
"We noticed the eyes of the turtles had turned white. They would sit still on a log and never jump off to catch and eat something. they'd gone blind and starved to death.
Harold and Annette alternate speaking of various marine creatures with intimacy and resolute calm, as if to lay each to its proper rest.
My dad found his cows tipped over, lying down, Harold continues. They had drunk the water. And the chickens. First they'd walk around, their wings hung down. Then they'd lie down dead. And his herd of goats and sheep, all dead.
He gives a mirthless baritone chuckle that seems to say, what can you do? I feel as if I've come upon the scene of a slow-motion crime. Lee Sherman's tar buggy was only one part of it. Other companies and the state government were another. Continuing with a flash of indignation, Harold says,
my nephew used to raise hogs, and you know a hog can stand almost anything. Because of the bad water, my nephew had to cook the slop he fed them. But the hogs got out of the pen and went to drink the bayou water and died. The health unit came down on my nephew for not keeping his hogs away from the bad water. But they didn't do nothing about the bad water.
In their braided tale, Harold's, Annette's, and Derwin's, I feel both resignation and defiance. As they talk, they glance toward the window at the bayou beyond, downward toward their plates, and occasionally to me to see how I am absorbing their words. There is no insisting on response, only a shaking of heads, as if to say, all this should never have happened. They have been kept waiting for years for word on a lawsuit, a wait that has nearly worn them down and spent their anger. But there is more. Animals and fish are not all they have lost. I brace myself. Shifting in his chair and coughing slightly, Harold continues,
my brother-in-law, J.D., was the first. He came down with a brain tumor and died at 47. And my sister next door, Lily May, had breast cancer that went into her bones. My mom died of lung and bladder cancer. And others up the bayou. Edward May and Lambert both died with cancer. Julia and Wendell live 2 miles from here. They got it. My sister grew up here but moved over to Houston River, and she's fighting cancer. And my other brother-in-law, he had prostate cancer that went in the bone.
Both Annette and Harold are cancer survivors.
The only one that didn't get cancer was my daddy, Harold says, and he never worked in the plants. Everybody else? All us kids and our spouses that lived on these 40 acres come down with cancer.
In Harold's immediate family, all those who got cancer, except for Annette and Harold, died of it. No one in earlier generations, like that of Harold's grandfather, suffered from or died of cancer. And as Pentecostals, no one in the family smoked or drank liquor. At a loss for words, I ask obtusely, so is the water cleaner now?
Oh, no, Derwin says. After a hard rain, the bayou rises and pollution from the plants gets mixed in with it, and you can smell something bad. Nowadays there's talk of cleaning it up, but I don't know how they can.
The three turn to talk of how one gauges the safety of fish these days. And very different philosophies emerge. Harold won't eat fish out of bayou din. That in itself spells danger.
On TV they try to play down any danger, he cautions. After the BP, British Petroleum spill, they said the shrimp were fine to eat. But is anybody checking them? I don't think so. I wouldn't eat them.
Then to his parents' amazement, Derwin tells how he judges safety by the look, smell, and digestibility of a fish.
I don't worry if the shrimp smells good and tastes good and feels good after you eat them.
Harold cautions,
but still, they could be dangerous. We used to eat fish all the time, but only every now and again now, and never from this bayou. As for fishing, I do catch and release.
I caught and cooked me some of them reds, Derwin continues, because them redfish migrate to here, all the way from the Gulf. Just because they're here now doesn't mean they spawned and grew up here. The reds don't stay here like gar. So a while back I figured, well, I'm okay. I took them, I cleaned them, I tried smelling them before cooking them to see if I could maybe smell any kind of little funny smell that didn't smell like normal fish. They seemed like they was kind of normal, but I didn't have any of that gar way down by the Gulf to compare them to. I cooked them on the pit, barbecued them, and then I ate them. I was trying to pinpoint any kind of funny taste, but I was like, man, it tasted good. I ate them.
Annette looks at her son with loving concern. To Derwin, the criterion is the fish's breeding habitat. Redfish are safe, gar is not. Harold agrees with Annette. No fish from the bayou is safe. But if he were to eat it, Harold adds, he'd eat the safe part of the fish.
I asked the man from Fish and Game where he took the flesh from the fish when he tested it. He told me, I take the fat tissue of that fish, and I also take the dark part of the flesh. Your chemicals lie in the fat tissue and in the dark part of that fish. So then I said, I'm glad I talked to you. If I eat that fish, I ain't going to eat the belly or the dark part.
The Napkin Map. A while back, Mike Tritico, the marine biologist and longtime friend of the Arinos, had drawn me a map on a napkin. In the middle was a dot, representing the Arinos' home on Bayou Din. A mile and a half east of it was Pittsburgh Plate Glass, PPG, where Lee Sherman and Harold Arino had both worked. I was later to travel by boat with Harold and Mike around the Lake Charles estuary to the very bank where Lee had secretly dumped the tar buggy of toxic waste into public water. Tall, broom-like, silver-green cord grass grew along the bank, hiding Lee's terrible secret through its very appearance of normality. Now owned by another company and renamed Axiol, PPG is a chlorinated hydrocarbon manufacturing facility. 4 miles east of the Arino's home stand the Conoco docks, the site of a 1994 leak of over 1.5 million tons of ethylene dichloride, EDC, one of the largest chemical spills in North America. 4 miles north from the Arino's home is Entergy's coal-fired electricity-generating Nelson Station. 2 miles to the north is Willows Springs, a black settlement on which, in 1982, a hazardous waste management firm, Brown and Ferris International, dumped waste in open landfills, sickening the local citizens. Also to the north is Sasol, the mighty South Africa-based energy and chemical company, now building the first U.S. gas-to-liquids plant and the largest new industrial facility expansion in the United States. Beyond that, 300 miles to the southeast, in the Gulf of Mexico, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig had exploded in 2010 in the worst marine oil spill in world history. Bayou Din was at the epicenter, I realized, of an entire petrochemical empire. And of the great paradox. Most of what polluted the bayou sank to the bottom of it. Mercury, heavy metals, ethylene dichloride, EDC, and chlorinated dioxins. So at first, the danger lay mainly there. But when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers twice dredged the nearby ship channel to ease the passage of commercial ships, they scooped
the toxic sludge from the bottom and pasted it on the banks right and left without marking where they put it, Harold tells me. So now the Arinos can't trust the banks either. That was a decision of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The federal government, I noted. What about stricter regulation of the polluters, I ask, wondering if the Arinos had voted for political candidates who pushed for cleaning the mess up, or, like Lee Sherman, had not.
Stricter regulation would be good, Harold replies.
We're not against industry, Annette clarifies. We were happy when industry came. It brought jobs. We were glad for Harold to get one. But for decades now, they've done nothing to clean up the bayou or compensate us to move. Like other friends and family, the Arinos are Republican and had voted in the presidential election of 2012 for Mitt Romney.
He's a big business guy, of course, Harold explains. If he were here, he'd be having friendly visits with the CEOs of the companies around here. He wouldn't be cleaning up the mess.
But Harold and Annette speak with a mildness of manner, a flatness of voice that makes me sense I am inquiring into an area of life in which they'd mostly given up interest.
We vote for candidates that put the Bible where it belongs, Harold adds. We try to be right-living, clean-living people, and we'd like our leaders to live that way and believe in that, too.
Before settling on Romney in the 2012 election, they had favored the former senator from Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum. The Arinos disapprove of greedy corporations stepping on the little guy. Oil interests tried to suppress the development of the electric car, Annette adds. Agreeing, Harold says,
Republicans stand for big business. They won't help us with the problems we've got here.
But Republicans put God and family on their side, and we like that. The scripture says Jesus wants us to be about his Father's business, Annette says. Their faith had guided them through a painful loss of family, friends, neighbors, frogs, turtles, and trees. They felt God had blessed them with this courage to face their ordeals, and they thanked him for that.
I don't know what people do if they don't know him, Annette adds.
For the Arinos, religious faith has moved into the very cultural space in which politics might have played a vital, independent role. Politics hadn't helped, they felt, and the Bible surely had. For governor of Louisiana, the Arinos had twice voted for Bobby Jindal on grounds of faith and family values. Jindal wasn't for cleaning up the environment, however. In remarks to the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank, he had said that emissions regulations and environmental protections were a way President Obama was holding our economy hostage to their radical ideas. In 2014, Jindal had also given $1.6 billion to industry as incentives to invest in Louisiana. $394 per citizen of Louisiana, while simultaneously cutting about the same amount out of the state budget and laying off 30,000 public sector workers, among them nurses, nurses' aides, medical technicians, public school teachers, and safety inspectors. People on the right seemed to be strongly moved by three concerns: taxes, faith, and honor. Lee Sherman was eager to lower his taxes, the Arinos to protect their Christian faith. Added to these basic motives were certain personal wishes. Lee, who had borne the guilt of polluting public waters and been cheated by a dishonest official at a tax office, wanted to feel vindicated. The tax office was corrupt, and taxes themselves were connected to dishonesty, he felt. One didn't know where they went or for what.
The Arinos shared Lee's concern but added another personal wish. Given their extended ordeal and the importance of God and the church in getting through it, they felt a powerful drive to place themselves in spiritually guided hands. For both Lee and the Arinos, at issue in politics was trust. It was hard enough to trust people close at hand, and very hard to trust those far away. To locally rooted people, Washington, D.C. felt very far away. Like everyone I was to talk with, both also felt like victims of a frightening loss, or was it theft, of their cultural home, their place in the world, and their honor. The politicians who most won their trust offered no help on cleaning the place up. And those who offered help? Well, who were they? What were they pushing? That was the dilemma. Both Lee and the Arinos had voted for Republican Congressman David Vitter, who voted in 2011 to eliminate the entire Environmental Protection Agency. He also voted against a National Endowment for the Oceans, which would protect oceans, coastal areas, and Great Lakes ecosystems. He battled the EPA on its report of a relationship of formaldehyde exposure to cancer and won a score of zero on the League of Conservation Voters' scorecard. As for threats to coastal Louisiana from climate change, no one they voted for thought it was real. Republican Governor Jindal had called climate change a Trojan horse from which would emerge a new horde of government regulators. Lee Sherman thought the idea of climate change was a bunch of hooey. It was a big state idea. It evoked liberal fear, not conservative suspicion and bravado. But Harold and Annette and Mike Tritico bent over their Bibles from time to time in the Arino's living room to study the Book of Revelation, chapter 11, verse 18. There it was written that God would bring ruin to those who ruin the earth. In the Book of Mark, chapter 13, verse 19, they also found, "For there will be greater anguish in those days than at any time since God created the world, and it will never be so great again." Through these passages, the three brought their faith to bear on the issue of climate change, and given his training in marine biology, Mike brought science to it. Together they worked out that climate change was, indeed, a man-made disaster in waiting that called for strong countermeasures. In the climate of opinion around them, they were brave to do so. But their concern raised the question, how could repairs be made? On that, the Bible gave them clearer answers than politics did. The Rememberers.
"They don't even want no fishing or swimming signs up around here," Derwin observes. "Some time ago, signs was put up, but someone took them down. Who did that? I don't know. But it seems like whoever they were, they don't want people to know, or if they knew, they don't want them to remember, that it's polluted around here. On TV, you see these ads for Shell Oil with beautiful egrets flying across a green marsh, music playing. You wonder what they're trying to make us forget," he says. We are on to dessert and coffee, and there is a nodding of heads around the table. The Arinos didn't simply remember the good old days of a clean Bayou Din. They remembered against the great forgetting of industry and state government. This larger institutional forgetting altered the private act of mourning. And not just that. It altered the Arinos' very identity. They had not left Bayou Din. They were stayers. They didn't want to leave, and even if they had wanted to, they couldn't afford to. The polluting companies had given them no money to enable them to move, and the value of their house had now fallen, for who would want to live on Bayou Din Pass Road, even in a home as beautifully kept up as theirs?
The Arinos had become stay-at-home migrants. They had stayed. The environment had left. The Greek word nostalgia derives from the root nostos, meaning return home, and alga, meaning longing. Doctors in 17th century Europe considered nostalgia an illness, like the flu, mainly suffered by displaced migrant servants, soldiers, and job seekers, and curable through opium, leeches, or, for the affluent, a journey to the Swiss Alps. Throughout time, such feeling has been widely acknowledged. The Portuguese have the term saudade. The Russians have tosca. The Czechs have litost. Others, too, name the feeling. For Romanians, it's dor. For Germans, it's heimweh. The Welsh have hirreith. The Spanish, mal de corazón. Many who have suffered from this illness of heart have been forced to leave a beloved home that is itself still there. But Harold and Annette Arino live at home in an environment no longer there. I meet other rememberers, too. One man recalls forests of towering bald cypress, clear-cut in the 1920s. Plaques issued by the U.S. Forest Service now memorialize these trees in the Atchafalaya National Heritage Area. Some federal worker must have come up with the bright idea to call these venerable trees Louisiana Purchase trees, trees alive during the 1803 Louisiana Purchase. Other trees were named for being alive during the 1812 inauguration of Louisiana as a state. Those who cared about the state could now care about the trees. They were state ancestors. Paul Ringo, a member of a non-profit environmental group called River Keepers, didn't need such an idea to keep memory alive. Living in a cabin off the grid on the edge of the Sabine River, whose waters were inked by an upstream paper mill, Paul hears the nightly gurgle and roar of the Sabine. He tracks pollutants in it and escorts bands of prayer warriors who pray over the river. In truth, he himself is such a warrior. He holds sacred the memory of the Atakapa Indians who once inhabited the river basin and has helped discouraged descendants in negotiations with the state. "The Sabine River is a public river," Paul Ringo told me on a visit I paid him. "But if you can't drink in the river, and you can't swim in the river, or fish in the river, or baptize your young in the river, then it's not your river, it's the paper mill's river." Like the Arinos, Paul Ringo is a rememberer. But such thinking is not much shared around town, on two accounts. First, new business was coming to town, bringing with it a euphoric celebration of new jobs, new money, and new products. Talk was of economic progress, and nostalgia would get in its way. "Don't you believe in economic progress?" people could ask. Also, as a cause, environmental protection had fallen into the hands, people felt, of left-leaning government expansionists and do-nothing local officials. With one avenue of nostalgia blocked, the State Tourist Bureau has busily promoted another through Lake Charles's 75 annual festivals, fairs, and special events. Mardi Gras, a gala event second only to that in New Orleans, Cajun Zydeco music, and Lake Charles Contraband Days, 2 weeks of joyous celebration of the pirates of old. Then there is the Crawfish Festival in Bro Bridge, the Frog Festival in Rain, and the Giant Omelette Celebration in Abbeville. They put fun into memory. Many workers in the petrochemical plants were conservative Republicans and avid hunters and fishers who felt caught in a terrible bind. They loved their magnificent wilderness. They remembered it from childhood. They knew it and respected it as sportsmen. But their jobs were in industries that polluted, often legally, this same wilderness.
They had children to take care of and felt wary of supporting any environmental movement or federal government action that might jeopardize them. The general talk around town was that the choice was between the environment and jobs. On Fox News, in the local paper, in talk with friends, that was the refrain. Too much nostalgia for croaking frogs and clean rivers might seem like just that. Too much nostalgia. The basic feeling around town was that one shouldn't get too hung up on the environment, feel too nostalgic for cleaner times, or be too retro. That wasn't what residents were supposed to feel. That's because a fracking boom was on, and many new industries were on their way to Lake Charles to process the natural gas it freed from the cracked earth. So, ironically, strangely, embarrassingly, the memory of Southern environmental glory fell in part to respectful clerks in federal offices and to Northern environmentalists. With their memorial plaques, the federally financed U.S. Forest Service was inviting residents to remember the history of their own ancient trees. The New York-based Riverkeepers Alliance, started by Washington, D.C.-born environmentalist Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., reminded a local citizenry what could be lost if citizens didn't watch out. The Arinos welcomed these northern environmentalists as natural allies in their own difficult struggle, as did Mike Schaff, who had faced a great loss of his own. The Arinos were rememberers facing a strange structural amnesia. As the British anthropologist Sir Edward Evan Evans-Pritchard called it, when studying something utterly different, Evans-Pritchard had been researching a pastoral people of the Sudan called the Nuer, who had a remarkable memory for some things and completely forgot about others. Men and women both remembered 11 generations of male ancestors, for example, but largely forgot their female counterparts. There was, the anthropologist sensed, a structure to what they remembered and forgot that was based on the power of the Nuer's dominant institution, the kin system. Dominant within that system were men. So, memory, Evans-Pritchard reasoned, was an indirect expression of power. The Arinos faced structural amnesia about something else, and linked to a different source of power. The Louisiana Chemical Association, the Society of the Plastics Industry, the Vinyl Institute, Shell Oil, PPG Industries, and their leaders in government. Spokesmen for this source of power drew the popular imagination to the exciting economic future. The Arinos felt that their silent bayou, their buried kin, their dead trees, were forgotten, like the female half of the Nuer. Coming down on the little guy. Harold adds an important idea to that of Evans-Pritchard. The state always seems to come down on the little guy, he notes. Take this bayou. If your motorboat leaks a little gas into the water, the warden'll write you up. But if companies leak thousands of gallons of it and kill all the life here, the state lets them go. If you shoot an endangered brown pelican, they'll put you in jail. But if a company kills the brown pelican by poisoning the fish he eats, they let it go. I think they overregulate the bottom because it's harder to regulate the top.
It isn't just that the power structure rigs collective memory. It rigs the enforcement of rules, too. The higher up the ladder of power, the more likely one was to get off. The lower down, the less likely. Environmental regulation was like that. If the power elite want to forget about pollution, and if they impose structural amnesia on a community, you need an omnipotent mind to remember how things once were. You needed, the Arinos felt, God.
He remembers how it was. He knows what was lost. If the federal government was committed to a multicultural America that dimmed the position of the Christian church, it was getting in the way of that church, diminishing the importance of God, and it was God who had enabled them to survive their terrible ordeal. To Derwin,